Romans chapter 4, in the first hour we looked at verses 1 through 8. Now this hour we'll be dealing with verses 9 through 16. So let's read those now, starting at Romans chapter 4 and verse 9. Is this blessing then on the circumcised or on the uncircumcised also? For we say faith was credited to Abraham as righteousness. How then was it credited? While he was circumcised or uncircumcised? Not while circumcised, but while uncircumcised. And he received a sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith, which he had while uncircumcised, so that he might be the father of all who believe without being circumcised, that righteousness might be credited to them. And the father of circumcision, to those who not only are of the circumcision, but who also follow in the steps of the faith of our father Abraham, which he had while uncircumcised. For the promise to Abraham or to his descendants that he would be heir of the world was not through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if those who are of the law are heirs, faith is made void, and the promise is nullified. For the law brings about wrath, but where there is no law, there is also no violation. For this reason, it is by faith, in order that it may be in accordance with grace, so that the promise will be guaranteed to all the descendants, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. Again, in our overview of Romans, we're looking at God's plan of salvation, or what we call the revelation of God's salvation, in chapter 3, verse 21 through chapter 8, verse 39. We looked at the revelation of God's wrath in chapter 1 through chapter 3, verse 20, and now we're turning to the other side of that coin. First, we found out that God's wrath is deserved by all men, whether you're a pagan, whether you're a moral person or whether you're a religious person, doesn't matter. Everyone is deserving of God's wrath. We came in chapter 3 and found that out in verse 9 when we read, "What then? Are we better than they? Not at all, for we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, not even one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks for God." And so on and so forth. Now in chapter 4, we're talking about the topic of imputation. In other words, imputation is when God takes righteousness and writes that on my account, even though I don't deserve it. God imputes righteousness to the believing sinner. We looked at Abraham's relationship to faith and works in verses 1 through 8 of chapter 4. Now we're going to talk about Abraham's relationship to religious rites or rituals. And we'll talk about his relationship to the ritual of baptism and to law-keeping as well this hour. So verses 9 through 12 will deal with his relationship to religious rites or circumcision. And we note in verse 9, it says, "Is this blessing," and the blessing refers back to what he's been talking about in verse 1 through 8, that is justification by faith. Now this blessing, is this blessing then on the circumcised or on the uncircumcised also? Now, this is kind of a fair question because Paul has been talking about Abraham and he's been talking about David, and of course, they were both Jews. So the person reading this would say, well, yeah, that's fine, that justification by faith, it only applies to Jews. Why is he writing this to me? Well, Paul is going to argue that that's not the case now. He's going to argue that this righteousness by faith applies to everybody, not just Jews. Now the Jews, remember, they had the idea that their Judaism put them in a special standing with God. They thought that that brought about their salvation merely on the fact that they were circumcised, they were Jews. And that's what Paul is going to address in this section. The answer to this question is going to be no. In verse 10, he says, how then was it credited? While he was circumcised or uncircumcised? Not while circumcised, but while uncircumcised. So Abraham received righteousness by faith. That's the blessing we're talking about here. Now, how did he receive that? What condition was he in when he received that? Remember, we looked at it last hour at Genesis 15, and look back at Genesis 15 again, and we'll get some idea of the time element involved here, because it's kind of important in Paul's argument. In Genesis 15 and verse 6, we noted that Abraham was saved at that time because verse 6 says, then he believed in the Lord and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. In other words, God took righteousness and he wrote it down on Abraham's account. Why? Because Abraham believed God. Now, Paul's argument is going to be, was Abraham circumcised when that happened, when he became a believer, when he was saved? Well, if you look at Genesis 17, first verse 1 says, now when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abraham and said to him, I am God Almighty. So he's 99 years old. Down in verse 11, it says he institutes the covenant of circumcision. Verse 11, or the ritual of circumcision. In verse 11, he says, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you. So he's 99 when he was circumcised, when that was instituted. Now, in 16 of Genesis, it says, Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. So in 16:16, he was 86. And that's when Ishmael was born. But remember back in chapter 15, when we looked at it last hour, in verse 3, it says, and Abram said, since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir. So Abraham did not have children in 15:3. In 16:16, he was 86 when Ishmael was born. And in 17:1, he was 99 years old when circumcision was instituted. Now, Ishmael was born some time after 15:6. So if you, even if you're conservative and say it's a year, we're talking about at least 14 years, between the time that Abraham was saved and the time he was circumcised. So Paul's argument is, if you think that salvation comes by being circumcised, look at Abraham. He wasn't circumcised when he got saved. So you take the time element into account. And that's what these Jews were failing to do in Romans. So Paul says there's a 14-year gap here between the time Abraham was saved and the time he was circumcised. So how can you possibly say that salvation comes through circumcision or any other religious rite for that matter? So that's his argument. If we go back to Romans, we'll find out that there was a reason for this gap. Now, why do you suppose God waited 14 years to institute the ritual of circumcision after he saved Abraham? So I suppose God came up to Abraham in Genesis 17 and said, you know what? When I saved you back 14 years ago, I forgot something. We better take care of that now and have you circumcised. Is that why God waited 14 years? Because he forgot? Obviously, God doesn't forget. There was a reason for that time gap, and that reason is to prove beyond any possible doubt that Abraham gained his standing with God apart from a religious ritual of circumcision. So in this context, in Romans chapter 4, we'll see Abraham representing two groups of people. Now, everybody knows Abraham represents Jews because he was the father of all the Jews, and the Jews held him in very high regard. But Paul's going to say, you know what? Not only does he represent nation Israel, he represents the Gentiles in that he was saved before there was such a thing as Judaism, before circumcision was ever even instituted. Look at chapter 4 and verse 11. It says, "And he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while uncircumcised, so that he might be the father of all who believe without being circumcised." Who's the ones who believe without being circumcised? Gentiles. So Paul is saying that Abraham not only represents Jews, but he's the father of Gentiles as well. Why? Because he was saved before he was circumcised. Now, there's another period in Abraham's life when he was representing the Jews. That was after he was circumcised. And in Romans 4, verse 12 tells us about that. It says, "And the father of circumcision to those who not only are of the circumcision, but who also follow in the steps of the faith of our father Abraham." So he's father of, first, all who believe without being circumcised, in verse 11, and he's father of the circumcision, in verse 12, the Jews. So these two things that Abraham represents here. You know, remember again, the Jews, they associated their standing with God on their circumcision. They associated those two things. They had conveniently forgotten that Abraham found his standing with God before he was ever circumcised. And Paul's reminding him of this in this context. He's saying, you know, Abraham was saved 14 years at least, and probably more, before he was circumcised. So circumcision can't be a factor in his salvation. Well then, the question immediately comes to mind, why was he circumcised then? Why did he do that? Well, that's what Paul goes into now. Look at verse 11. It says, "He received the sign of circumcision." The sign. A sign is the Greek word semeion. Semeion means an outward distinguishing mark. Now, the little phrase "sign of circumcision" is what we call a genitive of apposition in Greek. And what that means is that the sign and the circumcision are the same thing. It's the sign which consists of circumcision. So circumcision, then, is a sign, an outward distinguishing mark, as the lexicons put it. That's what circumcision is. He goes on to say, "a seal of the righteousness of the faith, which he had while uncircumcised." Seal is the Greek word spragus. Spragus is a mark of ownership or confirmation. We see that word in the book of Revelation. Look at Revelation chapter 5. And we've been looking at Revelation, talking about prophecy on Wednesday nights. And remember, we have a lot about seals there, the seal judgments. That word spragus or seal can refer to a seal placed on a book. And that's what we have in Revelation 5:1. It says, "I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a book written inside and on the back, sealed up with seven seals." And these are the seals that sealed up that book. Remember, when they had a scroll, they could seal it at different places as they rolled it up. And you'd break one seal and you'd read part of it, and then you'd come to another seal and you'd break that seal and read another part of it. And those are the seven seals that we see in the book of Revelation. So this seal can be the seal that holds that book together. It can also refer to an engraved object that was used to make the seal. And that's what we have in Revelation 7. Look at Revelation 7. Sometimes that's translated signet. You know, they used to take rings and push them in wax to make a seal, and that was called a signet ring. That word can refer to that too. It's an engraved object used to make a mark, and that mark denotes authenticity and confirmation and ownership. Revelation 7:2, it says, "And I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, having the seal of the living God. And he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants." So he had the seal that was going to seal or mark the 144,000 in Revelation. So that word sphragos or seal can refer to the seal itself or the object that makes the seal. It can also refer to a mark that is made by a seal. In 2 Timothy 2, we have that. 2 Timothy 2:19. Timothy 2:19 says, "Nevertheless, the firm foundation of God stands, having this seal." This is the mark. "The Lord knows those who are His." So that's a mark. And everyone who names the name of the Lord is to abstain from wickedness. So a seal can refer to the mark that's made by the seal. It can also refer to anything that's confirmed. Confirmed, and that's what we have in Romans chapter 4. 1 Corinthians has it in that sense too. Stop at 1 Corinthians on your way back to Romans. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, it's a confirmation or a proof. 9:2 says, "If to others I am not an apostle, at least I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord." And Paul says to the Corinthians, "You guys are the proof, the seal of my apostleship." So it can also refer to something that confirms or proves. Now look back at Romans 4:11. And we see it used in that sense here. First, what is circumcision? It's a sign. It's an outward distinguishing mark. It's a seal, a proof of what? The righteousness of faith which Abraham had while uncircumcised. So it's a confirmation of the faith that he already had. And that's Paul's argument here. He says Abraham was saved before he was circumcised. Why was he circumcised then? Well, because it's a sign. It's an outward distinguishing mark that points to something. His faith. It's a seal. It's a confirmation of something. Of what? His faith by which, or through which, I should say, he received standing with God. Interesting note, this word sphragos or seal was applied to baptism in the early church. Baptism. It's a confirmation of something that's already taken place. Why are we baptized? Well, it confirms that we have been saved. It doesn't save us, but it confirms the fact that we have placed faith in Jesus Christ and therefore have received standing with God. So the circumcision in Romans chapter 4 did not convey righteousness to Abraham. It was an outward confirmation of something that had taken place previously, and previously in this case is 14 years at least before that. So God's purpose in waiting that 14 years is so that He could be the father of two groups. And that's what I said before. In verse 11, it says, it says that he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while uncircumcised, so that he might be the father of, and he goes on to name these two groups. And that word "so that" is what we call a purpose clause in Greek. It introduces a purpose clause. Now, for those of you studying Greek, I know there's some of you here that are taking a Greek class. It's the words eis, ta, plus, and infinitive. When you see that, it's kind of a red flag. It tells you something. Eis, ta, plus, an infinitive means there's a purpose clause coming up. And that's what we have here. So that what? He might be the father of all those who believe without being circumcised, that righteousness might be credited to them, and the father of circumcision. So Abraham was actually the father of two groups. Now, normally we think of Abraham as being the father of Judaism, and that's true, and it's right, but you know, he's also the father of Gentilism, if you take it in terms of salvation. He's the father of believing Jews, the father of believing Gentiles. So the ones that he says, the father of all who believe without being circumcised, is a spiritual group or a spiritual people. Those are the believing Gentiles. He's the father of believing Gentiles. And then we have a physical nation, the believing Jews. And that's verse 12. And the father of circumcision, to those who not only are of the circumcision, but who also follow in the steps of the faith of our father Abraham, which he had while uncircumcised. So he's the father of two groups, actually. Now, the trouble with signs in the last part of verse 12 is simply this, and we're going to look at problems with signs and problems with law-keeping this hour. The problem with signs is simply this. A sign may be present with the corresponding reality, as it was in Abraham's case. Now, circumcision was a sign that he had faith in God. So that was a sign that had the corresponding reality behind it. But you know what? A sign can be present without the corresponding reality behind it, can't it? A lot of people have been circumcised in history without having faith in God. So that's the problem with signs. They don't really tell us the inward reality. Now, God knows the inward reality, but the problem with signs is they don't gain us standing with God. Only that inward reality gains us standing with God. Now, man, he has a habit of placing his confidence in the sign rather than the reality behind it. Now, it's just like a wedding ring, and I used the example a couple of weeks ago. Is it the wedding ring that makes people married? No, that's just a sign of it. And not everybody wears their wedding. I used the joke before. I don't wear my wedding ring because it shrunk. And it doesn't fit on my finger anymore. So that doesn't make me married or not married. That's just a sign of it. And that's exactly the same thing with circumcision. Now, this applies to circumcision, baptism, communion, mass, church attendance, anything that you want to talk about. The inward reality is the issue, not the outward sign of it. And that's what we have standing with God based on, is that inward reality, faith in God. Abraham believed God. That was the inward reality. What did God do? He reckoned it to him as righteousness. He credited it on Abraham's account. He wrote down righteous because Abraham believed him. We'll see that not all Israel, even, is Israel. And we had this here in verse 12. It says, "And the father of circumcision, to those who not only are of the circumcision, but who also follow in the steps of the faith of our father Abraham." So in one sense, you can say all Israel isn't Israel. Now, all Israel has the outward sign, But not all Israel has the inward reality that goes behind it. Look at chapter 9. We'll hit this subject more over there. When we get to chapter 9, in verse 6 it says, "But it is not as though the word of God has failed, for they are not all Israel who are descended from Israel, nor are they all children, because they are Abraham's descendants. But through Isaac your descendants will be named. That is, it is not the children of the flesh who are children of God, but the children of the promise are regarded as descendants." So not all Israel is Israel, and that's the trouble with signs. Not everybody that has the sign has that inward reality behind it. And I like the way J. Vernon McGee puts it. He says that same thing applies to us, you know, because not all churchianity is Christianity. And you see lots of churchianity in our culture. You know, you see churches everywhere, big, small, medium-sized. But not all of that churchianity is really Christianity. And not every church has the inward reality behind it. And that's the issue with God. Not the outward, but the inward. Now back to Romans 4. We'll talk about Abraham's relationship then to law in verses 13 through 16. We just found that Abraham did not find any standing with God based on religious rituals. He was circumcised after he had become a believer. Now, what about the law? You know, the Jews say we can obtain standing with God by law keeping. Well, Paul's going to point out there's that time problem there again, because Abraham was saved before there ever was such a thing as the law, as the Mosaic law. He was way before Moses. Now, the Jews had kind of forgotten that, or intentionally didn't notice it, because Abraham, everybody knows, is saved because the Old Testament says so. And he was saved 430 years before the law was ever instituted. So this section is going to deal with a fundamental question. How does man obtain standing with God? And there are going to be two answers. Man's answer, by rule-keeping. God's answer, by faith. And that's what Paul is going to talk about in this little section. He's going to say that the promise made to Abraham and his descendants is to be appropriated by faith and not by rule-keeping. And I'll tell you why I say rule-keeping instead of Mosaic law-keeping in a moment. Verse 14 is a clarification. It says, "For if those who are of the law are heirs, faith is made void and the promise is nullified." What verse 14 is going to clarify is simply this. A guy comes along and he says, "Yeah, that's great, Paul, you know, that faith stuff. I'll buy into that. I'll have faith in Jesus Christ. You know, but I kind of like the works thing too, because a lot of people say that we can obtain standing with God through works. So I'm going to mix the two. I'm going to cover all my bases and I'm going to say, yes, salvation comes about by faith, believing God, and I'll add some works to it, some rule keeping, some law keeping." And Paul's going to correct this idea in verse 14, and he does so very emphatically. Now, in verse 14, it says, "For if those who are of the law are heirs..." Now, the definite article is not in the original text. It does not say, "For if those who are of the law are heirs." It says, "For if those who are of law." There's no "the," no definite article. What does that mean? Well, that means that it's talking about a principle rather than a specific in this case. It's not saying the law. And if he said the law, it would be referring to the Mosaic law. He's just saying law, any kind of law. What's a law? It's something that demands obedience. He's saying that any kind of a system that says you have to keep rules to get standing with God is a law system. And that's what he's talking about in this verse. Now, is the Mosaic Law included in that? Sure. The Mosaic Law is a rule-keeping system. But is it limited to the Mosaic Law? No. It's any rule-keeping system. So you can say, yeah, well, those Old Testament guys, they had that Mosaic Law. They didn't know what they were talking about. You can't find standing with Mosaic Law. But if you join the church, you can find standing with God by... And you can list the rules that we find in churches today for people to have standing with God. Not dancing, not smoking, not watching television, not going to movies. If you keep these rules, you'll get standing with God. Now, what does Paul say about that in verse 14? What does he say about rule-keeping systems? He says that if those who are of law are heirs, and that's heirs of the promise, then what does that do to faith? Faith is made void. And the if in this verse, in verse 14, in the Greek, is what we call a first-class condition. Again, we had one last hour. What does first-class condition mean? It's assumed true. And Paul is assuming this true for the sake of argument. He's saying, you know, if those who are of law are heirs, and let's assume for a second that they are, then if you believe that, there's two other things that you have to believe. They go right along with it. If you believe that standing with God comes from rule-keeping, then you also have to believe that faith is made void. And that's what he's saying, void here. He says, if those who are of law are heirs, faith is made void. And the word void is the Greek word kanao. Kanao means to remove the power or significance of something. So if you believe that standing with God comes about from rule keeping, then you also have to believe that faith has lost its power. And that's not all you have to believe. Second, you have to believe that the promise is nullified. He goes on to say, if those who are of law are heirs, faith is made void, and the promise is nullified. Nullified is a Greek word, katargeo. What katargeo means is to put out of business. To put out of business. And it's interesting to note that both of these words in the original are in the perfect tense. Now, the perfect tense, you'll remember, it talks about an action that took place in past time, and the results are still abiding. So, in this case, we can say it's a state or a condition brought about by a previous action. So, what Paul's argument is that if standing with God ever was obtained by rule-keeping, ever, at any time in the past, if standing with God was obtained by rule-keeping, then faith is forever without power or significance. It's lost its power forever. And the other thing is that the promise is permanently out of business forever. That's the perfect tense. It's saying if there ever was a time when standing with God came about by rule-keeping, then faith is permanently lost its power, and the promise is out of business forever. So you cannot mix faith and works. And that's the point here. You can't mix them ever. You can't mix them even a little tiny bit. You know, people like to mix in just a little bit of works. I'm going to hedge my bet a little, and I'll say, yes, salvation comes from faith in the finished work of Jesus Christ on the cross, plus baptism. Or they'll say, yes, salvation comes from the finished work of Jesus Christ on the cross, plus you have to go to church every week, of course. That's not what it says. It says if you put anything as a condition of salvation other than faith, you've just taken faith and put it out of business, or you've taken the promise and put it out of business. You've taken faith and you've removed any significance that it had. So very important that we don't mix those two. Now, am I saying it's wrong to go to church? Of course not. Am I saying it's wrong to be baptized? Of course not. But those are outward signs of an inward reality. And Paul is dealing with the inward reality here. He's saying salvation is not a product of outward signs, be it circumcision, be it rule-keeping. That salvation or justification or righteousness is a product of faith, and it comes through faith. Faith is the means we use to appropriate. It's not a reward for believing. It's through believing, and I'll get to that in a moment. So any amount of rule-keeping to obtain standing with God ruins faith. So then, what's the purpose of the law? Why did God give the law? If rule-keeping can't bring standing with God, why did God give the law? Well, verse 15 tells us, "For the law brings about wrath." That is, the law causes man to become the object of God's wrath. Law brings about wrath. How does it do that? Well, it does it by setting forth a standard of conduct. Now, it sets forth a standard of conduct that man cannot keep. Therefore, what is God? He has to judge man. Why? God is righteousness. You can't take God's love at the expense of God's righteousness. So the law brings about wrath in that it defines a code of conduct that no human can keep. And that has to be answered by God by His wrath. Remember in Galatians, we studied that in detail. So what does that mean? Well, it means the law tells me that I'm a sinner. It points out that sin. It tells me that I can't possibly find standing with God by law-keeping. Can't do it. Therefore, I'm deserving of God's wrath, and there's nothing in the world I can do about that. So I have to throw myself on God's mercy and say, you know what? There's nothing I can do about my sinful condition. I'll have to accept what Christ did for me on the cross. So I have to believe that. And that's what the law does. It tells us, you can't save yourself. There's no possible way. So you have to appropriate God's salvation that He's given. How do I do that? What does it say? Faith. Believe. Abraham believed God. God wrote righteousness on his account. Now he goes on to say in verse 15, "For the law brings about wrath, but where there is no law, there is no violation." And we looked at this a little last hour. Before the law, there couldn't be a violation. Why? You can't break a law if there's no law, is the idea here. And that word violation is the word parabasis. Parabasis means to step over. And it implies to step over a line. Now, what do you need to have to step over a line? You need a line. If you don't have a line, you can't step over the line. And that's what Paul is saying. Before there was a law, there was no violation of law. There couldn't be, because there wasn't any law. So, think about this. When Cain killed Abel, did he break the law? There wasn't a law. How could he break the law? You say, wow, that must mean Cain was saved automatically, because there wasn't any law to break. Well, remember we looked at chapter 5 last hour, and in chapter 5, verse 13 and 14, it says that even though there wasn't law, there was something rotten because men died. And that 13, it says, "For until the law, sin was in the world. But sin is not imputed when there's no law." And that's the same principle he just said in chapter 4. If there's no law, you can't break the law. So how do I know that sin was still in the world? Verse 14, "Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam." Now, Adam, he had a rule, didn't he? He had a law, and he broke the law. But Cain and Abel, there was no murder law because the Mosaic law hadn't come around yet. So Paul says that even though there was no law, people died all the way from Adam up to Moses. Why do you suppose that is? Well, because there's something rotten in man to begin with. And again, we'll get to that in chapter 5 when we look at those verses. So, does this mean Cain was automatically saved when he murdered Abel because there wasn't a law to break? No. No, it doesn't. Again, we'll see in the future study. Now, verse 16 and 17 point to the necessity of faith then. In verse 16 it says, "For this reason it is by faith." What reason? "In order that it may be in accordance with grace." So the first reason that faith is necessary is because it is the only act that's in accordance with grace. Remember grace, the word charis, it means unmerited favor. So the only thing that man can do that's in accordance with God's means of dispensing salvation by unmerited favor is to believe. That's all he can do. It's the only thing that is excluded from the works category. Look at Romans 11. Romans 11:6 says, "But if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works." Why? "Otherwise, grace is no longer grace." So the two are set in opposition again. Now, I had somebody explain to me one time what grace was. He said, yes, God is a gracious God and we're saved by God's grace. What that means is that if we work all our lives as hard as we possibly can, and if we achieve a certain level of works, then God will pick up the rest, and that's grace. Well, that's very interesting and fascinating, but that's not grace. You know, grace means unmerited favor. It doesn't mean a helping hand if I do a certain amount. It means unmerited favor. And we've seen in two verses that grace and works can't be mixed. You can't mix them. Because if I say that, if I say, yes, I have to work as hard as I can and God is going to pick up the slack at the end of my life, you know what I've done? I've just nullified the promise and I've just taken away the significance of faith. You can't do that. You can't mix the two. So if salvation is bestowed as a reward for even one good thought or deed, then it's not salvation by grace anymore, is it? It's salvation by works because it's a reward for something we've done. Again, the Bible says that faith is not a work, and it's the only thing that falls into that category. Second necessity for faith is that the promise might be certain. And look back then to Romans 4. In verse 16, first we had, "For this reason it is by faith, in order that it may be in accordance with grace, so that the promise will be guaranteed." And that's the second reason, is that in order that the promise will be certain and guaranteed. There's a problem with works. And it's the same problem that we had with religious ceremonies. Remember the problem with circumcision? You can have circumcision with the inward reality or without the inward reality. Problem with works is, have I done enough works? How much is enough? You can never really be sure, can you? Are my works acceptable? Are they the right kind of works? Have I done enough works? Are my works of the proper quality? How can you be sure? You can't be sure in a work system. And that's why Paul says that faith is necessary. He says that so that the promise will be guaranteed to all the descendants. Now, man, he loves to draw lines. We love to draw lines. We say, you know, I'll use an illustration that Donald Gray Barnhouse uses of a person that says, you know, there are people starving in the world. And I'll pick on Betty this morning. And I'll say, how can you drive a Cadillac or a Mercedes when there are people starving in the world? How can you do that? But, you know, you could also say, well, then, how could you dare to drive a Cadillac? So you sold your Mercedes and got a Cadillac. You may not like Cadillacs, I don't know. But if you did that, would that be okay then? Well, a Cadillac's still a pretty cool car, you know. Why don't you sell your Cadillac and get a Buick? Now, would that be morally right in a world where people are starving? Well, a Buick's still pretty good. I don't have a Buick, you know. Why don't you sell that and buy a Ford? Is that conscionable? Can you say with a good conscience that you can drive a Ford? Well, you know, Ford's still, it's above a Hyundai, isn't it? I mean, everything's above a Hyundai, so why aren't, can you, if you get a Hyundai, will that be conscionable then when people are starving in the world? How can I have a car at all? You know, I should walk because people starve in the world. You see what I'm getting at? We love to draw lines. We love to do that as people. But we have to be careful about that. Because, you know, if you turn this around, you say, well, I can find favor with God by praying, for example. I'm going to pray 4 hours a day. Is that enough? Maybe I have to pray 5 hours a day to find standing with God. And it's the same principle. There's just no end to it. We love to draw lines, but we should be very careful at drawing lines. And Betty, I'm sorry, you have every right in the world to drive your Mercedes. And I'm just happy as can be to live in a country where you can do that. So I have to pick on somebody. You just happened to come up this week. So how many hours do I have to pray during the course of a day? Is 4 enough? Is 5 enough? Is 6 enough? Well, gee, the Bible says to pray without ceasing. Now, when am I going to eat lunch if I pray without ceasing? We just like to draw lines, and Paul is saying that that's the problem with works. You just can't be sure. But with faith, it's not in my hands anymore. All I have to do is believe that Jesus Christ died on the cross and paid the penalty for my sins. That's all I have to do. I believe that. And if I believe that, then there's nothing I can do. So I can put my trust in the God who provided the means of salvation rather than in myself for trying to obtain that salvation. So the grace method of salvation brings assurance, and it's the only method that does, and that's what Paul means in verse 16 when he says, so that the promise will be guaranteed, and it'll be guaranteed to all the descendants. So if you trust God for your salvation, you can be sure, because you know why? God isn't going to mess up. And when Jesus Christ died on the cross, he paid the penalty for my sins. You know what? He did a good job of that. And he's the only one who could have done a good job for that. So I trust that for my salvation. And then I can be sure. And this assurance applies to Jews and Gentiles alike. He says, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. Again, Abraham's the father of everybody, Jews and Gentiles alike, when it comes to believers. Okay, and with that, we'll stop now, and next time we'll pick up at verse 17. Father, thank you again for your word, which is living and powerful. We thank you for the wonderful plan of salvation that you've given us, and we just trust you in your work of sending your Son to die on the cross to pay the penalty for our sins. It's in his name we pray. Amen.